other people.
Yeah, I don't know.
We are right now looking at 14 point numbers. And so we last time we were talking about the floating point number representation, specifically the IEEE standard, which is IEEE 754 standard. And you will find a brief summary on this green card, and you can see the formats for single precision and double precision numbers. And also you see a table there with and we are going to be looking at this table. Shortly. So I had mentioned that there you have the usual type of floating point numbers. So you have the normalized numbers. And we are going to refer to them as the usual type. Now the idea behind normalized numbers is that in a normalized number, you always, the number will always look like this. One point something, perhaps 0, 0, 1, 0, whatever. So this is a 1 and 2 raised to whatever. So this is always 1 in a normalized number. So there's a single binary digit on this side of the decimal point. And in that case, we say that this is a normalized number. And normally our assumption is that except for the exceptions and except for intermediate results, the numbers are always going to be represented as normalized numbers. And so the normalized numbers, as I have mentioned and you have seen that before, you have this one that is always there, and in fact for normalized numbers this one is implied, as you already know. In other words, it is not represented. So you have, if you are using single precision, you are using those 32 bits, so you will not use a bit to hold this, so that way you save one bit and you can increase the resolution of the number. That's the idea. And I had mentioned that you have the biased exponent. And for the biased exponent, the bias happens to be, in case of single precision, 127 for a single precision. And it happens to be 1023 for double precision. And as I had mentioned before, biasing is needed so that you can sort these numbers easily. So if you want to sort floating point numbers, so so if you have a floating point number which looks like this, let me take two positive floating point numbers. Let me take some number. 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 1. And then you have some mantissa, huh? Which is, let us say, whatever. And you have another number, which is 0, 0, 1, some number, doesn't matter. So here, so that part is exponent. And they're both positive numbers, so the sign is not the question here. So which of the two numbers is a bigger number? This one here, right?
Yep.
So notice that there is no sign bit in the exponent. However, you do have, when you look at the values, you can have exponent both positive or negative, and that is accomplished. So whatever you see here, to figure its value out, you have to subtract, if it is single precision, 127. And we were talking about and I have given you an example of converting a floating point number. So, and in our example, we had something that looked like this. I think that was the number. And we had shown that this single precision number comes out to be minus 24, and that is the exponent. So you should be able to do such conversions. You should be able to go from decimal to binary, from binary to decimal. Any questions so far? Okay, now let's look at special cases, and let's look at this table in the green card here. We have exponent, fraction, which is the mental sign, and the object represented. By object, we mean what kind of number it is. If it is a number. So that's the same table that you have here. So I'm just copying it from there. Okay, one special case is representing a zero if your exponent and fraction are both zero. So 8 bits of exponent are zero, and then you have a fraction which is 23 bits. If that is also zero, that means whatever you are representing is a zero, depending on the plus or minus sign. Now usually the sign would be set to zero, so the whole thing is zero, but sometimes even if the sign bit is one, even then it represents the same value. So that is how zero is represented. So it's actually easy to remember. You can represent a zero by having all 32 bits equal to zero, right? Okay, now let's look at the next case when the exponent is zero. And by that I mean when the exponent is all zeros, right? So by zero I mean all zeros. And your fraction is something which is not zero. In that case, you have here a denormalized number. Now this is a special case, we will talk about it shortly. And then you have, if the fraction is zero, let's talk about if the exponent is somewhere between 1 to max minus 1. Can everyone see this? from 1 to max minus 1. Okay, max is all ones. So let me define max here. Max is equal to, for single precision, 255 for single precision, and it is equal to 2047 for double precision. So max really stands for all ones, right? If you have 8 ones, represent 255, right? So anything between 1 to max minus 1. Now that is the usual case. And here you can have anything. And here you have a usual floating point number, plus minus usual type, or we can say normalized. Normalized floating point number. So this is the usual type. Okay, and now when they were coming up with this format, they decided that it would be nice to be able to represent infinity. So they came up with a way to represent infinity. So if a fraction is zero, and this is exponent is all ones, we are referring to that as max. In that case, the number represented is plus or minus infinity. Now there is another case. In some cases, the result is not a number, and usually that indicates an error in the calculations. Max, and if it is anything not equal to zero, then the result is said to be not a number. So, of course, this is an interesting case when so all zeros represent zero. We talked about the normalized numbers. Now, sometimes you need a denormalized number. So, remember, I had mentioned that if you look at the range of floating point numbers, so here you have zero. Zero, of course, is a special case, right? And then you have a range of numbers that you can represent. Now these are the usual types of numbers, floating point numbers. So these are these normalized floating point numbers. Now remember, a normalized floating point number will always assume this hidden one. And this hidden one would give us a problem, because sometimes we would prefer not to have a hidden one. Because sometimes you want to represent a really small number. And so if you want to have a really small number, what we want is a zero here, and maybe a whole bunch of zeros here, and maybe a few ones here. That would be a really small number, right? So if you want to get some really small number, and so for example, if you want to get a really small number, that would be a number like, here's a small number, 0. I'm simply looking at the fraction part, not talking about the exponent. 0, 0, 0, 0, and all zeros and a 1. Now that is a really small number, right? Multiplied by 2 raised to minus whatever is the largest exponent. So you can make a really small number if this is not required to be a 1. So in order to be able to represent very small numbers, we have this case, the denormalized. In this case, we have no assumed 1. So number is not assumed to be normalized. And a number is interpreted in this way. Let's look at the denormalized numbers. Now, let me ask a question. How important are floating point numbers? Would you say they are very important, or those are things that you occasionally use? That is actually true. In some cases, for example, let's say you want to do things like how many students are enrolled in a university. Now it is not going to come out in any fractions, right? So that's going to be a whole number. So for things of that type, or if you want to, let's say, calculate salaries. Now with salaries, I guess usually you want two decimal points, but I guess usually we are not interested in a fraction of a cent. So if you calculate in cents, you don't have to worry about the fractions if you did that. However,
what I was going to say is, depending on what you're doing, I mean, if you look at the number of microprocessors running cars and everything else, most of them don't have floating point units in it. The total number of processors that are out there that we're not interacting with, there's a lot of apps that don't need it. It's just the fact that real things like spreadsheets and pay and taxes.
That's true. So a lot of applications don't really need floating point operations. On the other hand, a lot of things do. And now, do the floating point calculations have to be accurate? And that actually is, now isn't it enough if you just round things? Like if you, how many of you are working on your tax return? So some of you are still working on your tax return. I guess some of the rest of you are already done, or I guess don't have any taxes to pay. Now, I guess IRS allows you to round things off, so you don't need to worry about cents. However, in a lot of calculations having to do with real numbers, so for graphics, you are going to need floating point. For scientific calculations, as you said, if you are going to do some scientific calculation and you have some real things like temperatures and so on. And if you are running, let us say, if you are doing some simulations, for example, if you are doing transistor level simulation, so electrical engineers, they use something called SPICE, which runs some iterative things. So if you are doing iterative calculations, if you are doing printing process simulation, it can be shown that if you don't have enough accuracy, then your results may not converge, or you might end up with the wrong answer. So in many applications, you do need to have accurate floating point results, although in many cases, perhaps you can do without that. So, and of course, floating point numbers. Now, do you think this is kind of overkill? Do you think this is too complex?
It's good for calculus.
It's a clever scheme, and as I was mentioning, it was a committee, and they thought about various ideas, and they came up with this. And it's actually a very reasonable design. And of course, accuracy is an important part of floating point numbers. So that is why we have the denormalized numbers. And in case of denormalized numbers, so you have, of course, exponent is zero. Exponent, so in that case, and non-zero mantissa. And in a floating point, a denormalized number would be evaluated this way, and you have to watch this carefully. 0. M mantissa, so that's what I meant. So this is mantissa is M, and let's call the exponent E. So no hidden one, right? And multiplied by 2 raised to, now exponent is all zeros, right? So it is minus bias minus 1. So it's actually not minus 127, but which is what you would expect, but actually would be minus 126. And you can get to some really small numbers. So with single precision, if you have single precision, what is the smallest number? And I'm not worrying about the sign. So the smallest number would be plus or minus. Remember, this is zero. What is the smallest mantis that you can think about?
When the exponent is really high, and the value is really small.
Okay, if when exponent is high, that means smallest. You mean high means on the negative side, right?
Sorry, say again.
So when you mean on the negative side. So the exponent, of course, is minus 2, I'm sorry, minus 126. That would be what would be presumed, because of course the exponent is zero. So here's the exponent, and what about the mantissa? What is the smallest mantissa you can have?
0.0001.
That is true. And so that must be 0.0001. And notice that we have here, how many bits did we say we have here? And we have there 23 bits, right? Okay, remember this bit is 2 raised to minus 1. So this has to be 2 raised to minus how much? 23, right? So plus minus 2 raised to minus 23 multiplied by, so this is the smallest number you can represent. So this comes a lot closer to zero than what you would get if you had that default one in there. So this would be a denormalized number. And of course, when you design your floating point algorithms, you need to take care of special cases like if you do a calculation and number result is too small, you have to make sure it gets represented in the proper denormalized format.
So is there some different stuff in the MIPS for that? Like a different way to say this is a denormalized?
Representing denormalized numbers? Yeah, so whenever, so this is what is implemented in MIPS. So this is actually part of, this is part of the IEEE standard, IEEE 754 standard, and that is what is implemented in MIPS. So you have in the floating point unit appropriate hardware that will take care of these things. So yeah, you have to have the hardware to take this into account. Any questions or comments? Okay, now let us look at floating point operations. And let's first take a look at floating point addition. And of course, subtraction is, I guess, another form of addition. Now, how do you add two floating point numbers? And now remember, the numbers in general would have different exponents. So first thing you need to do before you add them is to align the exponents. So make exponents the same. Now how do you make exponents same? So let's say you have a larger number with a larger exponent, a smaller number with a smaller exponent. Then which number would you adjust? Would you, now in, you have to adjust the number by shifting it one way or the other. So the approach is that you find the number with smaller exponent. Shift its mantissa to the right. Until exponents match. So basically you need to match the exponents, and you do this to the smaller number, and the reason is that relatively the error introduced, if you lose any bits, and the error introduced would be smaller. That is the idea. So after you have done this, then you will add the mantissas. Add the two mantissas because now the numbers are aligned. In other words, if you think in terms of the way you write numbers, the decimal point is in the same place. And then, now you need to get the result in the normalized form. Add mantissas and get the larger exponent. So which you already have, and then normalize the result. Now it is possible that you add two numbers, and when you add the two numbers, the result is a little big. So you move something on this side of the decimal point. In other words, the result may be bigger. So now you have two digits on the left hand side of the decimal point. That is possible. Or it is possible that you did a subtraction and the numbers were rather close, so the resulting number is really small. So your result now has is something like 0.0000, and then after that maybe some ones. So you need to normalize the result so that result looks like 1 point something multiplied by 2 raised to whatever is appropriate. So you need to normalize the result. And now we could stop here. But in some cases, it is possible that some funny things can happen. When you normalize the result, you may need to, there may be some overflow or underflow. Basically, you will have to generate an error message, and then you will have to round the number. So, now what they do in order to maintain precision, the result will have some extra number of bits. And then you need to chop off these extra bits, in other words, round the number. So let's say if you are calculating something in terms of dollars and cents, and if somehow some number comes out to be $25 and 25.6 cents. And of course, then you need to get rid of that 25.6 cents, because less than a cent, of course, that doesn't have a meaning. So you need to round, you need to somehow get rid of the extra bits. And how you get rid of the extra bits is called rounding. So you round the number. And then, if necessary, and let me put the, I don't know if I can squeeze the last step here. Maybe I should write here. Did they have to make this so complicated? Answer is yes, I guess, if you want to make it work. Intel, when they first introduced, I believe, 8386, that was their, I think that was the first of the 32-bit processors. And of course, they spent a lot of time designing the chip. Now, when you buy a processor chip, do you expect it to be designed perfectly, correctly, or do you think there may be some bugs in there? How many of you expect the chip to be perfect? Bug-free?
Yeah.
Are you expecting it to be bug-free?
Yeah.
Oh, why?
Paid for.
But, yeah. But
it doesn't have to be bug free, but it has to spit out the right answers at the end of the game.
Yeah.
We don't want to agree.
Is that not always the case?
No, it is absolutely not.
There was a famous design error. So the Intel engineers, they made a design error in designing the floating point unit. Most of the time, it will work correctly with almost all possible combinations, but there were some rare combinations for which the unit would not work correctly. So that became the famous Intel floating point bug. And of course,
what I was going to say is the Spark chip is known for having a bug in its underflow that it actually traps the software to handle. So I mean, in that case, the engineers, instead of fixing the chip, just trap out and go through a few hundred other instructions, which just kills your performance under certain problems. They actually have a special compiler flag to skip doing that.
Right, okay.
So like I say, I mean, almost every chip has some sort of workaround.
Oh, so you're saying that there is no such thing as a perfectly designed chip?
I worked in pacemakers for 10 years. We did perfect chips, but it took us forever to get one out.
Oh, okay, so you did get perfect chips.
As far as we knew somebody died if we didn't.
Oh, okay. So, it's kind of the same problem. In software, you know, you would like, when you buy an operating system, when you pay Microsoft, I don't know, how much they are selling Vista for? $125 or whatever. I haven't bought it yet. When you pay money to Microsoft, don't you expect it to work perfectly, or do you? Do you expect that it will have hundreds of bugs in there?
Our expectations have changed over the years.
So, I guess since you guys are software designers, so I guess you guys are a little bit more understanding towards bugs in the software. Actually, just like you can have bugs in the software, you can have bugs in the hardware. But of course, in some cases, as you're saying, they do spend extra time to make it as much bug-free as possible, and then they have some ways of getting around the bugs. But I guess that some of the things in hardware design also, it's a complex process and it's an iterative process. You design, you have to test your design until you get it sufficiently reliable. Okay, yeah, I was going to mention the last step here. So the last step is renormalized if necessary. So notice that all these steps are there. Many of the steps may not be needed in many cases, but in your implementation, you have to think about all of them, because you don't want any rare case for which your unit wouldn't work. So let's look at a quick example. And now this is just a simple example. Let us say we want to add two floating point numbers. Now for convenience, what I will do, I will represent the number in a simple form, something like this, so that we can understand it. Because if we have to write all 32 bits, then that will take us too long. So let us assume that we want to add these two numbers, and these two numbers are minus, in this case exponent value is 4 multiplied by 2 raised to 2 multiplied by 1.0001, and rest of them are all zeros. Let's assume. And the second number is, let's make it this, multiplied by 1.1, and let's assume that it is 0, just to keep our example simple. So here there's a 1 after 3 zeros. And we want to add these two numbers. So we use this addition algorithm. And first thing we do is we want to align the numbers. In other words, we want to get the two mentices, the two exponents, to be the same. Now, which is the smaller number? So this is the smaller number. So we are going to adjust the smaller number. So we are going to write, we are going to take minus 2 raised to 2 multiplied by 1.00010. And let me convert that 2. Let me adjust the exponent. And of course we keep the sign. We want to make this 2 raised to 4. Multiplied by, let us shift the mentissa appropriately so that we have the same value. So what should we do? 1, 2, we shift the decimal point by 2 positions, right? So, okay, watch this and see if this is correct. Okay, is my transformation correct here? Are these two numbers the same?
No.
Let me see.
I thought it was a trick question. I was just thinking because...
Oh, so...
Okay,
1, 2... I'm sorry, other way. So,
it should be to the right.
1, 2. So notice that I increased the exponent, but I decreased the value here. So on the whole, the value is still the same, right? So I basically...
Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
We should have moved it to the left, because it says right.
Let's see. Shift the mentissa to... Shift its mentissa to the right. Yeah, that's what we did, actually. We have moved it to the right. So see this one? It has been shifted to the right. So this way. Okay, so now that we have the two numbers aligned, we can go ahead and add the two numbers. And what would we get if we add the two numbers? And now, so the numbers to be added, okay, so the problem now is, we have these two numbers, minus 2 raised to 4 multiplied by 0.010001, and the other is 1, add these two numbers. And of course, to add the, now in this case, one of the numbers happens to be negative. And what we can do is use the same old negation trick. And we can negate one of the numbers. So to perform the subtraction, now remember, whatever we have seen when we perform, when we performing addition and subtraction, what we have seen for integers would also work for decimal numbers, provided the decimal point aligns. So if you want to perform this subtraction, we can do it this way. Let me write that number. So that is minus 0.010001. And I can write that by forming its 2's complement. This would be so its 2's complement is going to be 1.010110, and then we will add a 1. So this is 2's complement of the number. And now we are assuming that the sign bit is somehow is properly taken care of. So we are not worrying about the sign bit. And we will add this here. And so now we are going to take this here. And we are going to add 1.10000. And we take care of sign separately. And you will find some examples in the book, but in the textbook they have what they have done, they have taken the examples from decimal arithmetic. So I thought it would be more interesting to do it in binary, as the machine is supposed to do. So we add the two numbers, and adding the two numbers we get this. 1.00111. So, and you can see that our answer is supposed to be a positive. So this would be a positive answer, and multiplied by 2 raised to 4. So we are right now here. So I've gotten the exponent, and I put the exponent there. And I've gotten this by doing the subtraction. Okay, now we normalize the result. Okay, what would you get if you would normalize the result? If you would normalize this number? It is already normalized, right? So we don't have to normalize it. There's no overflow or underflow. It doesn't look like a number that is too big or too small for the precision that is available to us. Round the number, there is no rounding needed, right? Because here we have how many bits we have available. If it is a single precision, we do have, what did we say? We do have 23 bits available, which is plenty. So there's no rounding needed. There's nothing we have to chop off. So it will fit right into our single precision format. And that basically is the answer. So this is the answer. So notice, important thing here is aligning the exponents, making the exponents same. That's the important thing. So make the exponents same and then do the addition. And basically regular rules apply. Any questions or comments? Okay, now let us see how we would design a floating point unit. Now, as I had mentioned, you have generally you have a separate hardware block for implementing the floating point operations, and we want to implement the floating point operations. So what is a design for a floating point unit? What is it going to contain? Let's come here. So let's see the diagram of a floating point adder. And we need a lot of space since, or why don't we go to overhead? Why don't we go to the laptop here? Since the diagram is kind of large, now you know these Intel designers, they are fairly intelligent people, right? We know that because we have some Intel people, I guess, in Fort Collins, actually, a number of them. And so how did they make a mistake in designing just a floating point unit? Is that something that is, how complex is it? So this looks like, this doesn't look too hard, right? Let's see how the hardware will look like. Can someone turn this on? Okay, let's see if something is happening. Yeah, thanks. So let's take a look at the floating point error. Oh, unfortunately my algorithm is behind this, but anyway, you had it in your notes. So you can, okay, so what we need to do, we have the two numbers. And we want to add the two numbers. So what we need to do, now notice, incidentally, this gives us, gives a nice example of how you design a functional unit. So before we, let's talk about how you would design this. So first thing you do, let's say you, there's an algorithm that you want to implement in hardware. And actually just, this is general, whatever kind of thing, you maybe you want to do some graphical algorithm or whatever. So first thing you would do, you would describe your algorithm using some appropriate way of representing an algorithm. Now I wrote the algorithm in words, but if you are a professional designer, you would probably use some description schemes that are standard to represent your algorithm. And once you have figured out your algorithm, so you will specify the algorithm. And then you will identify the registers needed. So, for example, you will decide that, okay, here we need a register and other, this register for the holding other number, and then we need some registers here for holding the result, and then you will also need to identify components like ALUs, muxes, shifters. Now these are all combinational components. Register is a sequential component, right? Because it holds information. But other components are just combinational components. And then you will identify the paths needed. So basically you will need to have these components. So for example, we said identify the smaller exponent. How are we going to identify the smaller exponent? So what we do to identify the smaller exponent, take the exponent, take the two exponents, do a comparison, calculate the difference, and then here's the control unit. And control unit will take a look at the difference and decide which of the two exponents is bigger. And it is the smaller one that needs to be shifted, right? So you need to have a control unit. So you have a control unit. And control units looks at signals. It keeps track of timing, things need to be done at the right time, and will activate operations at the right times. So basically, it's just the stuff you see in orange, that is all control unit. So control unit is usually the last thing to be designed. So coming back to our algorithm, which we have specified. So we said that we want to make the exponent, so here, so notice here, so we have exponent A and exponent B. And we are going to arrange it using the control unit so that the smaller exponent is coming here. And the smaller exponent is going to be shifted. So we have here a mechanism for shift right. Right? So the smaller exponent is coming here and this would be shifted right. I'm sorry. The mantissa with the smaller exponent is shifted right. So notice that here you have the significand. Significand is another name for mantissa. So here we have the two mantissas coming, and here is the one that corresponds to smaller exponent, and that gets shifted to the right just like we did. And after that, you use this ALU to do the addition. So this ALU will add the two numbers. Or if there is a subtraction involved, we'll do the subtraction, whatever. So it's all built in into the ALU. And after that is done, let's see, what do we need to do? Okay, so we have, so we pick the larger exponent. So here we have the larger exponent coming in. And now, so here we have the larger exponent, which came out here. And here we are, we have the result that we have obtained after addition. Now, we need to do a normalization. So notice that this is the unit that is needed for normalization. And now you notice here that funny things can happen with normalization. So normalization means that you shift your mantissa left or right, so that basically you want one point something. Adjust the exponent appropriately, right? And then, now it is possible that maybe you have too many bits. And if you have too many bits, you need to do rounding. Now we are going to look at rounding shortly. And now sometimes it happens that because of rounding, sometimes things may change. So for example, if you have, let's say $99 and 75 cents, and if you want to round this number to nearest the dollars, how would you do it? So what will you make it?
100.
So you will make, so you are going to make it to 100.00, right? So notice that after rounding, you have one more digit here. So it could happen that when you rounded your binary number, you may have extra bits. And in that case, you need to renormalize it. So notice that there are things going around here. So after you go through this, you may have to adjust things, but eventually things will become stable and your final answer would be available here. So this is the floating point addition unit. And it basically is a direct implementation of the algorithm for addition that we had seen. And of course, you have to design the control unit appropriately so it does what we have said it should do.
Are we going to have to be able to rehash this out on an exam, or we just have to understand the conceptual work?
And you have to understand basically how this works. So you don't have to memorize this. How many of you have good memory so that you can remember a diagram like this?
Academic books.
Not many of us have that kind of memory. It's basically the idea. You should be able to do, you should be able to add two floating point numbers. So if I say, these are the two floating point numbers, add them and show me the steps that you have taken, so you should be able to do that.
line, blurs the trade-off between putting in two separate ALUs and just making one ALU and adding more MUXes? How do they make that decision?
Oh, why did they decide to use two ALUs rather than just one?
And MUXing it.
Yeah, this is one particular design. Now, typically in a design, you will have trade-offs. And then you evaluate the trade-offs. And so there's some designing. Design can be iterative. And you can incrementally refine your design. For example, remember we talked about multiplication? So in multiplication, if you look in the book, we actually skipped that just to save time. But if you look in the book, he gives a couple of different algorithms, and he refines the algorithm to use least hardware and to maximize the performance. So you can often refine your design, and sometimes there's a trade-off between amount of hardware and amount of time. Sometimes you use a little bit more hardware, and you can make your design faster. So sometimes that trade-off is available.
So that's what's going on here by using the two ALUs, it's faster?
Yeah, so if you have two of them, then you can do that in parallel rather than having to do it one by one. Now, another thing you notice here is that you see that you have things flowing from here to here. And so by the time, it takes a while for signals to come down here. Now this is the type of unit that is amenable to what we call pipelining. So in a pipeline design, you slice your design into a few slices and you arrange it so that while one slice is doing something, next slice is doing something else, next slice is doing something else. So you have different slices of this thing, and so you have several instructions active at the same time. So while you are doing something with one instruction, you are doing something else with another instruction, something else with another instruction. So this is something that you can chop into slices, and you can come up with a pipelined design. So basically, information gets into the pipeline, and it flows through the pipeline. And because of pipelining, we are going to come to pipelining later and look at the concept in a little bit more detail. But this is the kind of thing that you can pipeline for better overall performance, for enhancing your throughput. So generally, it is the throughput that you are interested in. You want more stuff flowing through your processing unit. But we will come to that later. Any questions on floating point addition? Okay, let's run through this one more time. So let me do it sequentially.
Is this repeated over and over again in hardware too, like the other adders? Or do you just usually have one of these on a chip?
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
Do you have a bunch of these all over the place on a chip, or are they just one? Always have like a bunch of
Question is, do we have just one floating point unit? In the past, there used to be just one. But now, what they have is, they want to maximize performance in the new chips. So they often have a number of different functional units. And what they do is they want to have as many instructions being executed in parallel. Even though when you write a program, you kind of think that everything is just sequential. So you might think that only one instruction is active at a time. But in order to maximize performance, what they have done in modern processors is that there are a number of things going on at the same time. And you can have a few of these. So you maybe have a few integer arithmetic logic units, you can have a few and you can have several instructions which could be active at the same time. And then of course, somehow you need to have a mechanism to schedule instructions appropriately.
Routing.
Yeah, so the routing of instructions and allocating them to functional units. Which is what makes process of design challenging. Because you have to make sure that things are flowing as much as possible, because you want to maximize the throughput. And also you have to make sure that there are no violations. Because sometimes one instruction generates a result which is used by the next instruction. In that case, you can't run the next instruction before you have done the previous one. So all these things, they need to be taken into account. And depending on how much time we have near the end of the course, we might get into that, take a look at that a little bit. So any questions on, okay, I was going to show this, maybe run through this one more time. So in the beginning, you determine, figure out the smaller exponent, and then you shift the matrix of the smaller number right by the exponent difference, and then you add the matrices, just like we did. And then you normalize the result. In our case, it turned out that the result was already normalized, so we didn't have to do it. But in general, the result needs to be normalized. And finally, the result needs to be rounded. So you have, in order to maintain high accuracy, in floating point units, now you can use higher accuracy by using more bits. Now you can always use more, if you use more bits, it is always going to be more accurate. But if you have, so for example, if you are using, if you think single precision isn't good enough for your calculation, you use double precision numbers. In fact, most programming languages will also provide you the capability of choosing either single precision or double precision numbers. But you can even have a higher precision, but what you often need is you want your accuracy when you have intermediate results. And so you have a few extra bits for temporary use which allow you to do correct rounding. And we are going to talk about how to do rounding next time. So we'll see how there are some extra bits are there and how we use those to make proper judgment about the right type of rounding. So when you do rounding, you have the type of rounding that you need. There are a few different ways of rounding, and some ways of rounding are actually more accurate, and we will see that next time. So we'll continue, and also progress report for the project is due next time. So that needs to be a brief, you should mention about what progress you have made, what you have done so far. Make sure you include at least a couple of references that you have been using. So I will see you next time.
Sure.